Hello, listeners, and welcome to Junk Dilemmas, an Irvine Welsh podcast. My name is Damien Kiley. I am your host. And every episode, I am going to talk about one of the collected works of Mr. Irvine Welsh, all of his short story collections, his novels, and the various adaptations of his work. This is episode number 3. If you listened to episodes 1 and 2, thank you very much for listening. We did, of course, cover Irvine Welsh's amazing debut, the one and only Trainspotting. And today I am going to talk about the adaptation of that debut novel, Trainspotting, directed by Danny Boyle from 1996. This is one of my favourite films of all time. So we're going to get straight into the backstory in a sec, but I just want to clarify a couple of things once again, that I'm not affiliated in any way with Mr. Irvine Welsh. I'm just a fan of his, and I will be discussing material of a controversial and adult nature, so that would possibly offend some people. So if you have any young children, usher them out of the room post-haste. Yeah, let's get into the backstory of the movie. So Trainspotting, the novel, came out in 1993. And as I mentioned in the previous episodes, it was essentially an underground hit initially, but then got more of a buzz really from the release of The Acid House about 6 months later. So a certain age group really latched onto that book, but it really helped the sales of Trainspotting as well. But it was created into a stage production in 1994, but also around this time, the team of Danny Boyle, Andrew MacDonald and John Hodge approached Irvine Welsh to buy the rights to make a movie. So they said that their goal was to produce a screenplay which would seem to have a beginning, a middle and an end, would last about 90 minutes and would convey at least some of the spirit and the content of the book. So Danny Boyle actually convinced Irvine Welsh to option the rights to him by writing him a letter in which he stated that writer John Hodge and producer Andrew MacDonald were the two most important Scotsmen since Kenny Dalglish and Alex Ferguson. So Irvine Welsh was impressed by this. He was also impressed by the fact that the trio wanted everyone to see the film and not just the art house audience. So apparently Irvine Welsh initially made the error of selling the rights to another producer that he had been talking to and somehow thought were connected to the trio, but this was not the case. And apparently Danny Boyle was rather upset with him initially, but this was all resolved. And in fairness to the other guy, who I don't have the name of, he did sell on the rights to MacDonald. So all was sorted out in the end. Andrew MacDonald actually then secured financing from Film 4, and Miramax were also involved in this. And they adapted a marketing campaign, which is quite memorable, obviously from, you know, the iconic lineup poster that we know from back when this was released. He basically used a similar marketing campaign to what had been used for Pulp Fiction a couple of years previously. So there was a whole range of what is now iconic posters, postcards, and reissues of the novel itself to tie in with the movie release. So it was the now iconic still of Ewan McGregor standing with his arms folded, soaking wet from, you know, just having emerged from the worst toilet in Scotland. And Danny Boyle even redirected a cut of the Lust for Life video for Iggy Pop, which was also re-released in 1996. The film was filmed primarily in Glasgow rather than Edinburgh. The only part that was actually filmed in Edinburgh was the famous chasing scene. And it was basically filmed on a budget of $1.5 million in about 1.5 months. And in the end, it made $16.5 US gross. It was released in the UK on the 23rd of February, 1996. And it actually got some further publicity in the United States. They say no publicity is bad publicity. Well, Senator Bob Dole, the Republican candidate at the time, he accused the film of glamorizing drugs and promoting the romance of heroin, but he actually later admitted that he hadn't even seen the film. But as I say, I don't think it did it any harm at all. So next I'm going to speak briefly on the plot and structure. Obviously a lot of the book had to be cut for a 90-minute film, but basically it essentially left just Mark Renton's story. So the book had been completely disjointed at times, as I discussed in episodes 1 and 2. And so it had to be reshaped, really, to have a narrative that was suitable for a film. reduced amount of characters, obviously the main focus being on Mark Renton. And there was the clever addition of his character's spoken narrative, which really furthered the story and kind of explained situations and other characters' traits. And I think his narration is out of sync with how it played out in the book, but it definitely works here. I mean, he sets up every scene with kind of quick character backstories, and I think screenwriter John Hodge done an amazing job here. And as I say, there's obviously less characters. There was no second prize, no Matty, no Davy Mitchell, no Stevie, and no Kelly. So I suppose, could any of these characters have been included and worked? I mean, arguably, all of them could have in some shape or form, but it obviously would have meant for a much longer film. You know, Kelly being there as the kind of romantic interest that we already have that with Diane. And I don't know, second prize, you know, his bag is alcohol. So I don't know if that would have fit the kind of overall narrative of the film, other than kind of being there as a drunk sidekick, maybe for Begbie at times. Amazingly, Gav Temperley does make it into the film, although he's not named Gav in the film, but he does come up in the credits as Gav Temperley. And I will discuss him and the actor who plays him later on in the episode. But we definitely have, you know, a smaller cast of characters than what was in the novel. And let's get into those now in the main characters. So obviously, once again, the main character is Mark Renton, and he is played by Ewan McGregor. Up until this point, Ewan McGregor had been in a Danny Boyle film. He was in Shallow Grave, of course. He was quite good in that. His first role, I believe, was in the Dennis Potter TV series Lipstick on Your Collar. I do remember seeing that in the early 90s. I don't remember too much about him in it, I'll have to be honest, but that was his first role. But I do remember liking Lipstick on Your Collar. And, you know, I like Dennis Potter productions in general. Obviously, you know, he's gone on to bigger and better things. Actually, the first thing I remember seeing him in after Trainspotting, when, you know, it was just Mark Renton mad. Well, he was in an episode of ER at the time, playing, I think, an escaped convict. You can probably find it on YouTube or something like that. But I remember that was a good episode. I didn't watch ER very often, but he was very good in that as well. But obviously, the whole world knows that he went on to play Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Star Wars prequels. He wasn't actually the first actor in the family who'd been associated with Star Wars. His uncle, Dennis Lawson, played Wedge Antilles in The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi as well. But I will discuss Ewan McGregor at length later on in the episode. Next up in the cast, Ewan Bremner, who plays Spud. Ewan Bremner, of course, had played Renton in the stage adaptation. I think I mentioned in your episode that I think he would have been brilliant in that, in playing a more loyal version of Renton to the novel, you know, just more warts and all. And, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Bremner, he's not as attractive as Ewan McGregor. And that's definitely pot calling kettle. Come in, kettle, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I think that he's probably closer to Welch's vision of Mark Renton. But he's just amazing as Spud here as well. You know, he just totally nails that character. And I believe he's worked with Irvin Welch since. He's going to be playing Alan McGee of Creations Records coming up quite soon, I believe, to be released. I believe the movie is going to be called Creation Stories. So I'm really looking forward to that as well. And incidentally, Ewan McGregor had also been in an episode of Taggart. And that's not going to be the last time I mention Taggart on this episode. Next up is Johnny Lee Miller, who was cast as Sick Boy. He's the only non-Scot in the main cast, and I believe he did actually audition in a Sean Connery accent. So obviously getting right in there with Danny Boyle and possibly Irvin Welch as well by bringing in the Sean Connery connection. And I must mention, as I'm recording this, we're just days since Sean Connery unfortunately passed away, an absolute legend, the original and the best James Bond. And incidentally, Johnny Lee Miller is the grandson of Bernard Lee, who famously played M in 11 James Bond movies. Johnny Lee Miller, he's probably most famous nowadays for playing Sherlock Holmes in the US TV series Elementary. I don't watch that, but I have seen him. He was the main villain in a series of the show Dexter. He played a character called Jordan Chase, and I thought he was quite good in that. And I also thought it was interesting that he went on to play Lord Byron in a movie after this, which is interesting because Sick Boy, I've read him described as Byronic at times in reviews of Trainspotting, the novel. But Johnny Lee Miller, he actually kept his Scottish accent throughout the making, even when they weren't filming. And some of the cast were actually shocked when they finished filming and heard his real accent for the first time. Next up is Robert Carlyle. Just fantastic. I'd seen Robert Carlyle up until this point in an episode of the show Cracker. He played a Liverpudlian psychopath in that as well, someone who'd been affected by the Hillsborough disaster. And I think in the episode of Cracker, he was going to bomb Old Trafford, of all places. So he's probably a fan favourite of a lot of Liverpool fans for that. But definitely the villain in that piece. I believe Christopher Eccleston had been considered to play Begbie. I like Christopher Eccleston, but personally, I do not see that at all. I think Robert Carlyle is perfect for this. He just brings all of Begbie's qualities, if you can call them qualities, character traits. He brings them all to the screen here brilliantly. And just to mention, Robert Carlyle also went on after Trainspotting to play a brilliant role in a film called Ravenous. He was playing this psychotic cannibal. So possibly typecast a little bit, but, you know, he's probably most famous on the small screen for playing Hamish Macbeth, so maybe not. Next up is Kevin McKidd, who played Tommy. And it's gas, you know, probably out of all the characters, of all the actors out of this film, Kevin McKidd is probably the one that I see most frequently on my TV screen. That's purely because he's in Grey's Anatomy. I don't watch Grey's Anatomy, but my wife does. And I've seen him a lot in that. He did, of course, go on and play a character in the movie adaptation of The Acid House, Urban Welsh's follow-up book, The Trainspotting, and I will be discussing that. The one thing about Kevin McKidd, I always felt sorry for him that he wasn't included in the classic lineup movie poster. And I always wondered, was that purely because his character dies in the movie? Spoiler alert. But I believe it was just down to the fact that he'd actually gone on holiday by the time they were shooting for that photo shoot. Kevin McKidd as well, he did famously appear in an episode of Father Ted. I think it was the Christmas special. He was one of the priests that was trapped in the lingerie section of a department store. And last but not least is Kelly MacDonald. This was her first role. She was 19 at the time and she was playing a 15-year-old in the movie. Diane, of course, was 14 in the novel. Brilliant, brilliant debut. She was just fantastic in this, I thought. And she's gone on to do some really great stuff as well. She was in Boardwalk Empire. She was in No Country for Old Men. And she was in Black Mirror. And she's a fantastic actress. I've just recently seen her in the BBC TV show Giri Hagi. It's a Japanese crime drama and she was excellent in that as well. So that is the main characters and any other character I will discuss as and when they come up. But let's get into it. Let's get into the breakdown of the story. Opening scene, we see a close-up of a pavement. It's Princess Street in Edinburgh. And then bang, a pair of Adidas trainers hit the pavement and are running. And we hear the drums of Lust for Life by Iggy Pop. Adidas runners, by the way, very impractical for running, highly fashionable, but crap for running nonetheless. But I believe Danny Boyle has said that he was inspired by Sabotage by the Beastie Boys, Bank Robber by The Clash, and Hard Day's Night for the inspiration here. We hear McGregor's narration straight away, of course. Brilliant voice throughout the film. He's no Morgan Freeman, but he's still just fantastic. So they run down, I believe it's into the Calton Road, just under Regent's Bridge in Edinburgh. He's hit by the car and, you know, stops and starts laughing at the driver maniacally. And I always wondered, is he laughing at the close call of almost being killed by the car or just the kind of ridiculousness of it all? But we then kind of get a montage of scenes in quick succession that gives you a quick insight into the characters. Their names come up as and when they appear on the screen. And, you know, we get a first look at the main characters of the book. So we see a football match in real life. This five-a-side team that the Skag boys are playing against is Calton Athletic, their recovery group. And I think they all spoke to them, for research purposes. I know Ewan McGregor certainly did. This match, it's probably been set up by the character of Tommy. And he seems to be the only one that's almost taken it really seriously. You know, Spud is in goal. He doesn't posing a very imposing force in goal. Begbie looks to be just there to break up people. Sick boy, you know, is just kind of blagging his way through the match. And Ewan McGregor, you know, doesn't look fit to referee the match, let alone play an impactful part in it. But you see the look of glee on Begbie's face as he's swiping a guy out of it, tackling him. Tommy is stranded at one stage with almost all members of the other of Calton Athletic Group having him cornered. Sick boys here in a pair of commando combat pants, which, you know, possibly aren't the best attire for a football match. Spud, on the other hand, is in very short shorts and a Superman t-shirt. And I just love the interwoven shots of Renton getting hit with the ball, you know, while he's in the wall for the free kick and then falling to the floor in Swannies. And then we are in Swannies. We see written on the wall, "Welcome to Mother Superiors." We can hear Sick Boy. He's given one of his speeches about Sean Connery. He's talking about how well the Bond films did at the box office. This is while they're all cooking up. Spud has gotten his shot first, amazingly. I know there's talk in the novel about, you know, the pecking order as to who gets their shot first. Spud never seems to be the first in the novel, but he seems to have been first here. And he kisses Sick Boy on the lips, which was another character, Raimi, in the novel. And then he falls backwards and bangs his head on the floor. And he just misses a couple of pillows that were there waiting for him. But Allison gets her shot then, a.k.a. the cock injection. Allison's played here by Susan Vidler. And, you know, it's a small role, but I think she's really good in it. I think she's quite attractive, even when she's, you know, in the midst of a skag orgasm. But she, of course, utters her famous line, "That beats any meat injection. That beats any fucking cock in the world." And I think it's Gathaway Sick Boy is kind of looking her up and down. I'm not sure whether he's admiring her or he's appalled that, you know, his cock isn't good enough for her and certainly is no match for heroin. But he's back to Sean Connery mode quick enough. And I love the line where he says, I'd say he was a muscular actor back then. So it's hilarious how often, you know, Sean Connery comes up in this movie, at least in spirit. We see Swanee then, played by Peter Mullen. Peter Mullen is just a fantastic actor. Amazingly, he was only 35 when he was filming this. You know, this really makes me feel old. But, you know, I think he possibly had a tough paper round, or maybe he's just meant to look that way, given the fact that, you know, the character of Swanee has obviously had a long-standing relationship with heroin at this point, a.k.a. the reason for his Mother Superior nickname. But, you know, Peter Mullen, I would argue that he actually has the best body of work of anyone in this cast. You know, he's just been fantastic in stuff like Red Riding, you know, obviously Ozark. He was in a brilliant series that called Quarry, which was sadly cut short. It was cancelled after one series. And he was brilliant in Westworld recently as well. And he was also in Taggart, as well as Rabsy Nesbitt, which, you know, is just looks brilliant on anyone's CV. He was also in Harry Potter and Braveheart, but I mean, Taggart and Rabsy Nesbitt, come on. Quick scene cut to Begbie then. Looks like he's in the snooker club with Tommy and Lizzie. And, you know, he's scorning the taking of heroin. You know, he wouldn't put shite like that in his body as he lowers back a large glass of whiskey. Tommy's condemning it as well. And a quick shot of Renton's parents also scorning heroin use. Renton's parents, played incidentally by the brilliant James Cosmo, who was also in Taggart, and Rabsy Nesbitt. And his mother is played by Eileen Nicholas, who was also in Taggart. Cuts back to Swanee's then. And interestingly, I noticed Renton is lying, you know, in a room by himself. So, you know, he seems to have, even at this early stage, kind of isolate himself from the other members of the group, even when he's doing heroin. I noticed that a couple of times with him when he's lying on the ground. And there is a lot of shots of him lying down, whether it is on the ground or in a bed or on a sofa. And I'll try and mention them as and when they come up. But as I mention it now, it's quite possible that Renton was first to shoot up here if he's already, you know, lying on his arse away from the rest of the group. But he makes the declaration to Swanee then, "That's it, Swanee, I'm off the gear." And Swanee suggests that he tries the Sick Boy method, which clearly isn't working. But, they make the mention here of the famous line from the novel that Sick Boy, you know, has always been lacking in moral fibre, but he does know a lot about Sean Connery. And finally, we get the train horn here and the movie title comes up with the kind of shadows moving like a passing train. I love that. And we're into the next scene, which is Renton barricading himself in his flat with copious amounts of soup, buckets and porn. You know, he wants to get off skag here, so he's locking himself away from the world. Change in soundtrack, by the way, it's Habanera from the musical Carmen. You know, we see a shot of him here. He's looking in the mirror. You know, he just looks fucking amazing. He's lost about 2 stone for this role. Just pale. He looks like a fucking vampire. I don't know if this is your classic heroin addict look, without being insulting to anyone. He just has this remarkable ability to look cool while still looking unkempt. But he ventures out here to meet Mikey Forrester. He's, first you see a good shot of him on the phone talking to Mikey. And, he's after taking down the boards that he's only just boarded up his flat door with. But he heads over, he meets Mikey Forrester, who is played by none other than Irvin Welsh himself. And he sees this kind of gormless, grinning character, but also has a snidey demeanour. He's wearing this sheepskin coat and a punk t-shirt. I wonder, did they actually belong to Irvin Welsh himself? He sells him the opium, and there's the famous line, "For all the good it'll do me, I may as well shove it up my arse." And he gives him a little smile. And then there's a great shot of Renton walking back past these flats, and they've all got different coloured curtains, and it's a really cool shot. It's almost Kubrick-like, very nostalgic looking almost. But he gets, a sudden dose of the trots, stomach cramps, he's keeled over, and he has to make his way to the bookies and the toilet at the back, and it is the worst toilet in Scotland, so I don't think it's quite as bad as described in the book. Doesn't have this fly that's buzzing around his head that he grabs and squashes against the wall and writes Hibs in, but it's still obviously really disgusting. And I think I remember two famous movie scenes from around this time of men relieving themselves in a toilet bowl. The first was in Dumb and Dumber by Jeff Daniels, which possibly pips this to the post, but Renton here is still fantastic, or Ewan McGregor, I should say. Just the glee in his voice as he's shiting in the bowl, but then obviously he realises that he's after shiting out the opium suppositories and has to fish them out of this putrid toilet bowl full of piss and shite. The clever, surreal imagery that Danny Boyle brought to the scene, as a way for Renton to step out of the reality of having to stick his hands in this filthy toilet bowl, to the music of Brian Eno, a track called Deep Blue Day. And it's just brilliant. He's swimming to the bottom of this blue ocean, and he finds the suppositories. They look massive, and they're kind of glowing like pearls when he takes them out and drops them on the floor. They look like, bonus points in a video game. I don't know whether it was intentional effects or just kind of dodgy effects, but Danny Boyle apparently was inspired by the novel Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, and also by the work of painter Francis Bacon. And I have seen a painting by Francis Bacon of a man on a toilet, and it actually reminded me of Renton in the toilet here. But I always thought it was a bit weird when he does make it back to his flat and he's soaking wet, and he can hear the squelching as he's walking into the room. But he looks almost too wet to have, obviously the reality of it was that he was just in this filthy toilet and had to fish the suppositories out of the toilet, but he wasn't actually swimming around in the bowl. But when he gets back to the flat, he's almost wet enough to look like he had been swimming somewhere, and I just thought that was a clever kind of blurring of reality for that scene. So next up is a scene where Renton meets up with Sick Boy, and the music for this scene is by Primal Scream, and it is a track entitled Trainspotting. I'm not sure if it was written specifically for the film or just for the book itself. I know Bobby Gillespie is a big fan and is actually good mates with Irvin Welsh, but there's some great narration by Ewan McGregor here. The downside of coming off junk is that friends remind me so much of myself that I can barely stand to look at them. It's just a brilliant line. I don't think it's actually in the novel. He mentions that Sick Boy has given up heroin as well just to annoy him, and they meet up in the park incident. It is the park that the grave scene is in Shallow Grave. And we hear Sick Boy's famous speech then, his kind of philosophy on life, where he says that at some point you've got it, then you lose it, and it's gone forever. And he's given examples of men that this has happened to: George Best, David Bowie, Lou Reed, whose later stuff is all right, but in your head you kind of know it's really shite. Charlie Nicholas, David Niven, Malcolm McLaren, and Elvis Presley. He gets around to talking about it. His whole point was to talk about Sean Connery. And he's saying here, all I'm saying is that I'm trying to help you understand that the name of the rose is merely a blip on an otherwise uninterrupted downward trajectory. And Renton asks him, what about the Untouchables? And Sick Boy says he doesn't rate it that at all, despite the Academy Award, says Renton. And I love Sick Boy's look at him here. I kind of agree with him. He says, that means fuck all. It's just a sympathy vote. And I have to agree with him there. A lot of the time, the Oscars are just a waste of time. And this leads into, it's a funny scene, but it is, an assault on an animal. It's obviously played, I think it's played out more comically even than the book. In the book, it's just pure dark humor. But here, the dog kind of gets, you know, a pellet to the arse and thinks it's his owner and then attacks him in the park. And, you know, it's a funny scene. Obviously, in the book, it's a lot more sinister because Sick Boy, who is on his own in the park in the novel, does step in and actually strangles the dog to death with its own collar, you know, to help out this man who's being attacked by his dog, and then gets recommended for a commendation by the cop that comes to help as well. So that's a real typical example of Irvin Welsh's dark humor at its best. But in the film here, it's just a funny little scene. And I know that there's, you know, a lot of animal lovers, dog lovers, that would probably take exception to that. I know I wouldn't like my pet to be assaulted in this way, but, you know, it is a funny scene nonetheless. And I love the Sean Connery impersonations by both characters here, but both actors. It's done really well. You know, do you see the beast? Do you have it in your sights? Sure enough, Miss Moneypenny. That's just my shite impersonation of the great Sean Connery, who passed away at the weekend. And next we see Spud and Renton jointly supping on a milkshake with two straws in a cafe. And they're both suited up. They're both being sent for the same interview. Although it's worth mentioning, in the main movie, we only see Spud's interview. But Renton's kind of giving him a pep talk here. You know, you need to make sure you try, but not too hard, or you might get the job. But obviously, you know, if they see that you're not trying at all, you're in trouble, they might cut your doll money. So as Renton says, it's a tightrope, Spud, a fucking tightrope. But Renton has a little pick-me-up for Spud here. He's got a packet of speed. A wee dab of speed is just the ticket, as Spud says. And we see him dabbing away, and then it cuts to the next scene, and he's just manic, you know, just rambling off words, rabbiting on. And it's a comedy masterclass here by Ewan Bremner, has to be said. And I love the camera work here. You know, Spud looks to be sitting about 50 feet away from the interviewers in an otherwise kind of empty room. Again, I think it looks quite Kubrick-like. But yeah, Ewan Bremner is just fantastic. You know, when they say to him, have you any weaknesses? And he says, yeah, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, actually. And what attracted you to the leisure industry? In a word, pleasure. In other people's leisure. Incidentally, the three actors playing the interview panel here, all three of them have been in Taggart. I'm not making this up. And next, it's one of the most famous scenes from the movie, I think. This was filmed in the Crosslands pub, which was formerly a church. I think it's still on the go, this pub, although possibly not at the moment due to COVID-19. But it's Begbie holding court, Robert Carlyle, and he's just in overdrive here. He's just brilliant for his first kind of proper introduction of the character onto the screen. You know, just hilarious facial expressions and mannerisms. He's just as good as any comedian. And, you know, the statements, you know, he's telling the story about playing pool with Tommy, and he's playing like Paul Newman, by the way. And I just love the way he's coming out with this story, you know, where the guy came in and starts staring at me. And I just love the ending to it as well. So after that, well, the game was mine. And, you know, he just flings the glass. And obviously we see the freeze frame then, where you kind of get a delay as to what actually happened with the glass. And you see the reaction of Tommy to the glass going over the balcony. And as Renton's narrating that, you know, we got the real story from Tommy a few days later, because he always told the truth. It was one of his minor defects. But also as well, I love the fact that Begbie thinks that the women at the table would be actually interested in that story he told. And, you know, obviously we hear the glass smashing and a woman screaming then. And you see Begbie putting the kind of insurance policy of a knife on the table and then rubbing his hands with glee before heading off down. And it's just a fantastic, you know, performance here where, you know, he goes down. And as it says in the novel, he's like a psychotic Mrs. Marple going down to find out who has glassed this lassie, and no cunt leaves until we find out what cunt did it. But I love the fact that when the row breaks out then after he kicks this guy in the nuts, you know, you see the rest of the crew, you know, Renton and co, just watching from the balcony. You know, they've obviously seen all this before. They've no intention of getting involved. And I love the little shot where a bit of glass has flown up and hit Renton on the hand, and he's kind of casually sucking his finger after being hit by it. But the whole scene just has this almost inexplicable air of slapstick about it, you know, from Tommy trying to miss the shots in the pool game to the beating of this poor nerdy lad who was eating the crisps that put Begbie off, you know, and it, even the throwing as the of the glass, you know, it's a horrific act, but just the way it's played out here, it's just also comical. You know, as I say, the freeze frame is just brilliant, where you're given a little bit of anticipation as to what actually happens with the glass while Tommy tells his real story. And, you know, you see Renton swapping the videotapes over as well. But, you know, I think I said on the novel episode, if you knew someone like this, it would just be frightening and you'd just totally be on edge the whole time. But to be able to watch it from a safe distance is kind of fantastic and just really entertaining viewing. I just want to mention another podcast that I'm involved with at times. If you're a fan of Trainspotting and other classic movies, then you might be a fan of classic UK TV as well, in which case you might love the Tales of the Unexpected podcast. If you remember the show, hosts Chris and Rob are working their way through every episode, talking about the good, the bad, and the weird of Tales of the Unexpected, often veering off course to talk about many other subjects as well. And as I say, from time to time, I am also a guest on the show. So check that out. Search for the Tales of the Unexpected podcast on all good podcast platforms. And folks, don't forget to follow our social media accounts. On Facebook, it's Junk Dilemmas, an Irvine Welsh podcast. On Instagram, it's Junk_Dilemmas. And on Twitter, it's Junk_Dilemmas. So check them out for updates on new episodes and content. We have a quick cut then to Renton and Sick Boy sitting in Renton's flat. They're watching Tommy and Lizzie's sex tape intently. And I think this creates a stirring in Renton's lines. And we have quickly cut to the next scene then, a very memorable scene in the Volcano Bar, which I believe is the real name of a nightclub, which is now sadly demolished. The music we hear is Temptation by Heaven 17. Temptation, the first of two songs called Temptation to be played in the film. And of course, Heaven 17 are named after a fictional band from the novel A Clockwork Orange. And the area that Tommy and Spud are actually sitting in is done up to look like the Maloko Bar from A Clockwork Orange. And the camera kind of pans around the nightclub. We see Begbie is in deep telling a story to a girl at the bar. He's clearly relaying the actual same pool club story to this girl who you can only imagine isn't terribly interested. You can see him doing the actions of playing pool and the guy staring at him. It cuts to a really funny exchange then between Spud and Tommy. Spud's girlfriend Gail doesn't want their relationship to start on a physical basis, so has been starving him of sexual contact for a number of weeks now. She read it in Cosmopolitan, of course. Resulting in Spud's testicles being like watermelons. And Tommy himself has his own troubles. He forgot Lizzie's birthday and bought himself an Iggy Pop ticket. Unfortunately, we don't see the chapter in the book where Tommy actually goes to the Iggy Pop concert lived out in this movie. Possibly would have taken off Renton's storyline too much, but I think Tommy comes across a lot nicer in the movie version. There's no instances of him fighting or... They really paint a picture of Tommy being a nice guy, which just makes what happens to him all the more tragic. But the other brilliant bit about this exchange is that because the music is so loud, Danny Boyle included subtitles, and there's some funny bits. There's a bit where Spud asks Tommy, did Lizzie go ballistic? And Tommy answers, big time, absolutely fucking rad, but the subtitles just say very. Of course, the girls come back from the toilet then, and there's a funny moment where they ask, what are you talking about? They said football. They asked the two girls, what are they talking about? And they say shopping. But it's a great little scene with, you know, arguably the two most likable characters in the whole movie. Sick Boy himself is also preoccupied with a young lady. We see quite a memorable moment where he passes, obviously, an ecstasy tablet to her via tongue. Nice work if you can get it. We don't get any of the dialogue, unfortunately, from the novel that accompanied this scene in the nightclub. You know, Sick Boy was brilliantly patronising to Renton and Spud when Renton was getting increasingly desperate to find the affections of a young lady. And it's no different here, even without that dialogue. You see Renton, it's quite an iconic image, really. He's standing in front of a picture which is on the wall of Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver, which is brilliant. You know, it's like two iconic movie characters, you know, side by side. but he is wearing a questionable t-shirt here. It's a little bit short around the midriff, which is all I'd say about that. Wouldn't be my choice of wardrobe, but then again, I don't have the figure of Ewan McGregor in this movie. But he starts walking around the dance floor then. I have myself made many a fruitless journey around the dance floor in my youth and made my way sheepishly back to the group of lads, the bachelor section, if you will, of a nightclub. You know, lads these days don't know how lucky they are to be able to jazz up false accounts of themselves on dating apps before they actually physically have to meet their prospective dates, which was the case here for Mark Renton. But he spots Diane and the music immediately switches to Atomic by Sleeper, not the original Blondie version. I'm not sure why Blondie's version wasn't included here. They would eventually, of course, make their way onto the T2, Trainspotting 2 soundtrack with the song Dreaming, which is also brilliant. There's a funny little scene where some guy has obviously agreed to get Diane a drink. She's getting pissed off at him. She's heading off, but he does catch up with her with the drinks, but she basically drinks both of them. And this, of course, is what convinces Mark Renton. With that, Mark Renton has fallen in love. And of course, he goes for the overly brazen approach here. You know, he's telling Diane just as she's leaving the nightclub that he'll go home with her, but he's not promising anything. And I have to say, Kelly MacDonald is brilliant here with her retort. You know, she's telling Mark Renton, do you usually find that this approach works? Or let me guess, you've never tried it before. In fact, you don't normally approach girls. Am I right? The truth is that you're a quiet, sensitive type. But if I'm prepared to take a chance on you, I might get to know the inner you. Witty, adventurous, passionate, loving, loyal, a little bit crazy, a little bit bad. But hey, don't those girls just love that? And I do love that. I thought it was a brilliant little exchange there just before she hops in the taxi. And he's obviously lost for words. She could have just told him to fuck off, of course. But she does immediately invite him into the taxi. So although she was pretty accurate for 95% of men with her description of him, it appears that she just meant, you know, for him to cut the crap and get on with it. He's a bit taken aback at first, but ultimately his 20-second chat-up method has worked. And he's in the taxi and he's away in a hack. And, you know, they're going at it hammer and tongs in the back of the taxi. And we get a little mix of scenes here. Spud is barely able to stand. He's leaning against the wall outside the nightclub. And Gail is telling him that she expects him to be a considerate and thoughtful lover, which is doubtful. Tommy and Lizzie are back at their flat and the passion is running high. And Lizzie actually requests that they put on the sex tape. But of course, they discover that it's missing. We cut back and forth then to Diane and Renton. They're back in her house. They're in her room and she starts undressing in front of a very large Andy Warhol painting on her wall. Renton is kind of standing there like a rabbit in the headlights for a couple of seconds. But she also supplies the condom. So very handy. All mod cons in this young girl's bedroom here. She drops it on the bed for him. Obviously, this is different to the novel, which they had unprotected sex. And Renton had some not very nice assumptions about her then. He was worried that he was going to catch something off her, even though he was the heroin addict in the relationship. But, you know, they have sex. And it's cut with some commentary here of a famous goal by Archie Gemmell in Scotland against Holland in 1978. And the TV commentator, Archie McPherson, he actually re-recorded his commentary, especially for the film, and specially altered, I believe. And he didn't actually know what it was for when he recorded it, but in his own words, he got paid for it nonetheless. Renton scores the penetrating goal, and coincidentally, the tape that he had swapped Tommy and Lizzie's sex tape for is that match against, you know, Scotland and Holland. And I have to say, Lizzie here is brilliant. You know, when she loses it, when she realizes that the tape is gone, Tommy is saying he thinks he might have dropped it back to the shop, and she's like, the fucking video shop, Tommy. She's played by an actress called Pauline Lynch here, who I don't think she did much work afterwards. She's actually an author now. Worth noting as well, Tommy's comically bad underwear here. But it seemed to do the trick for Lizzie until she realized that, you know, her sex tape was out in the general public somewhere. But back at Diane's, you know, she's in complete control the whole time here. Once they're finished, she throws him out straight away. And again, I just think Kelly MacDonald, for her debut role, is just so confident here, especially given, you know, Diane's young age, that you really believe that she's in total control the whole time here. And by the way, Renton, of course, lying down once again there on the bed on his back. And again, he's lying down in a scene a few minutes later when he's sent out to the couch, and that's where he sleeps for the night. But we cut to the next morning. We see Spud waking up, and Ewan Bremmer is just brilliant here. He's kind of totally lost as to where he is for a couple of seconds. I did think for a split second that when he looks down to the kind of dark stains on the sheets, that it was blood, you know, which would have been quite horrific. But luckily, it's not quite as sinister as that, but it is just as disgusting when we learn what is in the sheets. But yeah, his Scooby-Doo like, is just fantastic when he wakes up and doesn't know exactly where he is. Quick shot then of Tommy and Lizzie outside the video shop waiting for it to open up. And then it's back to Renton lying on the couch, and you can actually hear Diane singing in the shower, and she is singing Temptation by New Order, which makes it onto the soundtrack. And as I say, the second song called Temptation that was in the movie. I have read that apparently it was meant to be Golden Years by David Bowie that she was singing, but David Bowie chose not to be involved in the soundtrack to the movie, even though he's mentioned several times in the novel and his music is mentioned several times. But I believe I have read that he was involved in putting a word in with Iggy Pop, who obviously is heavily involved in the soundtrack. But Renton is woken up by the singing and also by a passing cyclist. And I love the little hello that Ewan McGregor gives him as he passes by, which I've read that was a nod again to the Beatles in the movie Help. When Ringo is discovered in the boot of a car, he gives a similar hello. But obviously it turns out, I believe, that this cyclist is Diane's father. And we learn that, you know, when he sits down with these two people at the breakfast table and Diane comes in her school uniform, that she is, in fact, well underage. Not quite as well underage as she was in the novel. She was 14 in the novel. She's meant to be 15 here. But this scene is played out quite comically, I think. And obviously most parents wouldn't quite see it like that. I know I fucking wouldn't. But I think it's one of Renton's worst character traits to spill from the novel into the movie, is the fact that he, you know, is initially horrified by this, but does continue then to have sexual relations with Diane later on in the movie, as he did later on in the book. But I suppose this is one of the reasons why Mark Renton is an anti-hero and not a typical protagonist whatsoever. For seeing, incidentally, both of Diane's parents were also in Taggart. But the next is the brilliant breakfast scene with Spud. So obviously he sheepishly enters the kitchen. Gail and her parents are sitting down to a slap of breakfast. We see Gail's mom has prepared a large plateful for Spud himself. There's a very large portion of beans. And as Alan Partridge would say, very close to the fried egg. The sausage was not used as a breakwater whatsoever here. But I just absolutely love the exchange here where Spud says, you know, I had a bit too much to drink last night. And I just really love the father's line back to him where he says, don't worry about it, son. It does a man good to cut loose once in a while. But we get the tussle then between Gail's mother and Spud. And obviously the contents of the sheets go all over this family. It's just brilliantly disgusting. And yes, Gail's parents, both of them, were in Taggart. Next, we see Spud, Renton, Tommy and Sick Boy getting off a train. They're standing on a platform. It's another kind of iconic image from the movie, which has been compared to that of the Beatles. They're at Corar Station at the foot of the mountain known as Liam Ulam, aka William's Leap. I always wondered actually how far of a train journey was this that they made. And this spot is actually about 3.5 hours from Leith by train. But some of the most iconic photos from the movie were taken here. There's a great shot of Ewan McGregor laughing with a large naggin of vodka in his hand. And we obviously get the very famous It's Shite Being Scottish speech by Renton in this scene. It's clearly an outburst of helplessness by him, you know, venting his feelings of being trapped, really. But I imagine that Renton possibly would have voted for Scottish independence in 2014, but I doubt he was surprised at the outcome of that either. But incidentally, this speech in the novel is in the same chapter, Searching for the Inner Man, as the famous Choose Life speech. And I remember I had a t-shirt with the whole It's Shite Being Scottish speech on it. I felt a bit like a bit of an imposter, but it was a pretty cool shirt. But I love Sick Boy's line here where he says, look, Tommy, I know you're getting a hard time off Lizzie, but there's really no need to take it out on us. But of course, ironically, Tommy's attempts at, you know, bringing a bit of life into the group, it was the final straw and forced him back onto heroin. And, you know, they're back on Skag in the next scene. And I love Renton's line, it looks easy, but living like this is a full-time business. And that cuts into a brilliant monologue of scenes. We get the music of Iggy Pop. Once again, it's nightclubbing. And I just love, that's probably my favourite song on the soundtrack. And I just love this little montage of scenes. You know, it's like the ironic use of that song for these mischievous activities that they get up to. I think that the main argument that was made at the time about this movie making drugs look cooler stems from possibly this one scene. But the music is clearly used ironically to be the backdrop for what's going on here. You know, they're stealing TVs from old folks' homes. You know, Renton's stealing from his own parents. He's robbing a prescription pad from the GP, car radio. And I believe writer John Hodge has said he was once a doctor and he encountered heroin addicts who had committed these crimes themselves, which is where a lot of this comes from. We see a little quick scene with silhouettes here, including clearly Begbie breaking into a house at nighttime. We see Tommy taking heroin for the first time. We see Swanee's kitchen counter being used like a place of business, you know, exchanging money for Skag. We see the scene where Swanee is injected in his penis by Allison. And, you know, the whole time, you know, while the crew is laid out, we see baby Don crying. You know, it's just a heartbreaking scene. It's just completely tragic. But there's humor in here as well. We hear Sick Boy talking about Ursula Andrews, the quintessential Bond girl, the embodiment of his superiority to us. Beautiful, exotic, highly sexual, and yet totally unavailable to everyone but him. Shite. Let's face it, if she'd shag one punter from Edinburgh, she'd shag the whole fucking lot of us. And then an even worse description of Honor Blackman. You know, what a total misnomer. I wouldn't touch her with yours. I'd sooner shag Colonel Klebb. And we, of course, then see Sick Boy's MacGyver-like heroin kit built into the sole of his shoe. That wouldn't help matters with the condemners of this movie either. But we get a scene then which actually has the description of the first day of the Edinburgh Festival. That's not the goings-on in the chapter in the book that had that title. But I just love the image of them all sitting at the bar and they're just their bored facial expressions. And then this tourist comes in and he's just so out of place. He makes the scene so funny. And obviously he gets a severe hiding in the toilets off Begbie. And you know, we do see shades of the sinister side to Begbie, which, you know, is described more in detail in the book, where Begbie pulls out a knife. Obviously, in the book, we learned that he didn't stop. But in the movie, he is stopped by Renton. And you see a nice smile on Renton's face as he grabs Begbie's hand, you know, kind of successfully reasoning with him not to go further on this guy, which is what happened in the book. Incidentally, the American tourist is played by Stuart McQuarrie here, who also plays Gav Temperley. So a double role for that actor in the movie. But I love when Begbie is counting out the money and gives Renton his share and then kind of shouts after him, "Hey, rent boy, nay fucking Skag." Weirdly looking out for Renton, which, you know, I mentioned he does do in the novel as well. There's brief showings of almost affection by Begbie at times. And I love this shot of the bar area. Again, it's camera work that's quite Kubrick-like, I think. But if you look closely behind the barman is actually wearing the American tourist's red jacket. And it looks like he's asking a punter at the bar how it looks from the back. But then after this humorous scene almost, even though it's an assault scene, we cut to the most horrific scene in the whole movie. You know, Renton's lying down. He's on heroin, clearly, as all the characters are. And then we hear Allison screaming. Again, this was a different character in the novel. It was Leslie, but it's Allison here. And, you know, it's just horrific. You know, you can see how everyone in the Swanee's flat has just taken forever to react to this. And Allison's screaming is just getting worse and worse. And there's a horrific moment where the camera pans across the front of the baby's cot. And just as Allison's, you know, scream just becomes torturous, you see this image of the dead baby in the cot. I don't know how good the special effects were here, whether they were accurate or not, but it's just, you know, horrifically unforgettable. And like in the novel, it's unclear whether it was neglect or a cot death that caused Baby Don's death. But what becomes clear, as in the novel, is that sick boy was her father. And I think Johnny Lee Miller is absolutely brilliant here, where he's asking Renton to say something and then shouts, fucking say something to him. And you can see the tears. It's a really emotional scene. It's a shorter scene than in the book, as there's no debate between any of the characters as to whether they should stay or not. You know, that doesn't come into it at all. I think, you know, Matty had been a main character in that scene in the novel. You know, he wants to get the hell out of there because he had a police record, but that does not come into play here. It's just the effectiveness of the fact that the child has passed away. And then the message is the same, though, because it cuts to Renton. You know, his only answer to this horrible turn of events is to start cooking up, not for disregard for the situation, I don't think, but almost for medicinal purposes to deal with the situation. Allison does ask him to cook her up a shot as well, and he says that he'll happily do that, but after him, it goes without saying, and that was, of course, the name of the chapter from the novel. But it changes the whole kind of atmosphere of the movie from this point. You know, I think I said on the first episode about the novel that it was a real gut punch as to how real things can get in this story. And the change of mood is reflected with the change of music. We get the song Sing by Blur, another brilliant song. There's a few bands on this soundtrack, which I possibly didn't get into until after the soundtrack came out, but Blur were not one of them. I was a fan of Blur since their very first album, which was called Leisure. And as Spud might say, I got a lot of pleasure in listening to Leisure. But this song, Sing, is just so melancholic and effective here. And you hear Ewan McGregor's narration, you know, saying that it wasn't just the baby that died that day. Something inside a sick boy was lost and never returned. And obviously we know that that leads to him becoming a pimp by the end of the movie. We see that he's leading the charge here into the John Menzies store, which is on Princes Street. There is a deleted scene where Diane spots them robbing in the store, but this was cut out. I think it would have broken the flow of this whole scene and certainly the effect of the song. But we get the same scene then from the start of the movie where, you know, Spud and Renton are being chased down Princes Street by the security guards. But obviously, there's a totally different feel to it straight after this cot death scene and with the change of song from Lust for Life to Sing. You know, McGregor is running just as fast, but there's just nothing upbeat about it this time. And it's, as I say, it's melancholic and it's just full of desperation. There's a brilliant image of them running down Hanover Street, which is in front of the Royal Scottish Academy. I love that shot. And actually, one of the security guards that's running after them is actually scriptwriter John Hodge. There's an extension then of the scene where Renton is hit by the car and starts laughing in the driver's face. You know, we see that it's revealed that he's tackled to the ground. And the next scene then is the courtroom scene and the just brilliant image of these wine-coloured Adidas trainers, which Renton has chose to wear to the court to go along with his suit. I've just always loved this from the first moment I've seen it. And I've told my wife that when I do die, I would like to be buried in a suit, but also wearing a pair of wine-coloured Adidas. No one else will know that they're there, but that's, I don't care. That's what I want. Interestingly, Gail and Lizzie are there in the dock, even though I would have thought that they'd long since stopped giving a fuck at this stage. And also there is Gav Temperley, as I say, played by Stuart McQuarrie. You know, it's the first of two scenes where he's just kind of hanging out at the back of a room. But yeah, we know that Renton gets off more or less scot-free and Spud is sent down. And I do, again, love Renton's kind of little retort to the judge. Thank you, Your Honour. With God's help, I'll conquer this terrible affliction. And you see the judge kind of looking at him again to check if he's actually taking the piss. Incidentally, the judge here, the actor, was in Taggart. And a cut then to another brilliant scene where they're back in the pub celebrating Renton's release. And a brilliant description of what's just happened by Francis Begbie. It was fucking obvious that that cunt was going to fuck some cunt. And, you know, I love Renton's mother here. Oh, listen to Francis, Mark. He's talking sense. And then Begbie again, fucking right I am. See inside, he says as he points to Renton. You wouldn't last two fucking days. And then sick boy also playing up to his kind of good guy act for Renton's mother. There's better things than the needle rents. Choose life. And a little wink then to clearly wind up Renton, but it's almost like sick boy is breaking the fourth wall there by, you know, just mentioning the movie's famous slogan. And we see Spud's mother then enter the pub and obviously everyone goes silent. And Renton stands up sheepishly, you know, hands in his pockets. He looks hilarious standing here in his ill-fitted suit and Adidas runners, you know, to face Spud's mom. And he's obviously feeling very bad with the fact that, and in his words, Spud went down and he didn't. It wasn't fair. But then without saying a word, Spud's poor mother is hit with a barrage of insults from Begbie, you know, basically calling her a bad parent. Which is slightly different to the novel, where she did come in kind of shouting and roaring and accusing them all of being, you know, heroin addicts and getting her son in trouble. But it's not the case here. She just lambasted by Begbie, as I say, for it all being her fault, essentially. But Renton wants to get out of there after this. You know, this causes him to want another hit. And it's at this point that he says, you know, one of, if not my favourite line, I wish I'd gone down instead of Spud. Here I was, surrounded by my family and my so-called mates, and I've never felt so alone, never in all my puff. And I love the surreal image of him climbing up on the wall, you know, when he goes through the back of the pub and jumping off, and then just instantly landing in Swanee's, like, you know, he flew there somehow. It's just a more kind of surreal imagery by Danny Boyle. But there's a great, you know, tongue-in-cheek exchange here between Swanee and Renton. It actually reminds me of Jack Torrance and Floyd, the barman in The Shining, you know, where Jack turns up and says, oh, it's a bit quiet now tonight, Floyd, and, well, you know, what can I get you, Mr. Torrance? It's a good exchange here, you know, where Swanee's offering him garlic bread and regret to inform sir that his credit was reached and breached quite some time ago. Yeah, that's a bit different to The Shining, where Jack Torrance's credit was just fine, apparently. But, yeah, Swanee presents Rents with a ready-made hit here. Now, unless Rents gave him his own clean works before this scene, it is different to the novel, where he says that he never shares. You know, we see a pretty close-up camera work here of him shooting up. I believe a prosthetic arm was used for this. And it's a bit too much. He goes into an overdose, and we're treated to A Perfect Day by Lou Reed on the soundtrack. And the music hits just as he injects. You know, we see this close-up of the blood and the dirty contents of the syringe. And Renton just lays back, sinks into the floor. You know, red carpet and all sinks in with him to represent his, you know, OD'd state. And it's just really well done by Danny Boyle. You know, we hear Swanee, perhaps sir would like me to call him a taxi. You know, we see a POV, a point of view by Renton here, as Swanee is dragging him down the stairs of his flat. The flat looks to be in the middle of, you know, Beirut or something here, by the way. It's pretty secluded area that Swanee set himself up in. The taxi arrives. We see an ambulance first, but that's just a red herring. You know, it is a taxi that is actually called. There's no question of him drawing attention to his to Mother Superior's home base, essentially, by bringing an ambulance outside. But the taxi man here, no questions asked, you know, in he goes. And evidently no job is too big or too small for this cab driver. But we see more point of view shots of him in the taxi. Swanee has given him a £10 note, I think it is, into his breast pocket for the journey. And then we see him gently being placed on the pavement by the taxi man and left outside the hospital's emergency ward. So then he's on a stretcher. He's being dragged along by the hospital staff, who look like they've seen it all before, far too many times. And then he's brought back with an adrenaline shot. This reminded me, of course, of really one of the few 1990s cinematic rivals of this film, Pulp Fiction, where John Travolta brings Uma Thurman back to life with an adrenaline shot. And we see Renton kind of rising back up from essentially 6 feet under, and just at the point where Lou Reed is saying, you're going to reap just what you sow. It's just perfect. It's brilliant. And then we cut to his bedroom. He's been brought home, you know, by his parents. We see him in the back of a taxi first and foremost, but, you know, he's still kind of dead to the world. But he's in his room then, and the music switches, by the way, to Underworld, Dark and Long. Not the original version, though, the Dark Train remix, which is still really good. You see the train's wallpaper. You see a lot of Hibs FC posters and badges. And once again, we see Renton lying down in a bed. And another famous line here: I don't feel the sickness yet, but it's in the post. And another great line: too ill to sleep, too tired to stay awake. And I don't want to make light of how bad the situation is for Renton here, but I have felt a bit like that myself after a night of vodkas and Red Bull. But I have had some horrific sleepless nights of sleep, you know, over the years, in my younger years more so. But so you have a bit of a clue as to what he's going through here, really. But I love the way the camera work, you know, extends the room. Again, it's, you know, I keep saying it, but it is quite Kubrick-like in terms of the camera imagery. We see the train starting to move then quite slowly. They'd move a lot quicker at the end of Trainspotting 2. But the hallucinations start then. You know, we see Diane at the end of his bed. She's singing Temptation by New Order once again. He then sees Begbie under his sheets, a terrifying sight for anyone, but another brilliant line, you know, you sweat that shite out of you, because if I come back and it's still there, I'll fucking kick it out, okay? And then takes a little toke of the fag, it's brilliant. And then a horrible image, it's Baby Dawn appearing on the ceiling, just a horrific concept. You know, I've heard some people question the special effects here, but I, you know, you could argue that it kind of adds to the surrealism of it all. I've been in the company of someone who just laughed themselves silly at the sight of this, but which spoiled the desired effect a little bit for me at the time. But it's still a horrible concept, as I say. And McGregor's just immense here, you know, his screaming. And then, you know, you just feel every aching bone in his body throughout this scene of him going through withdrawal. We get some cuts then to a TV show. Obviously, in the novel, he had been sitting in the sitting room, I believe, with his parents watching a quiz show, you know, as he's going through this. But for the movie, they've just cut scenes intertwining, and it looks his parents are actually on this game show. It's Dale Winton, RIP, making a cameo here as the game show host. And the game show seems to be questions about viruses. So, you know, it makes more sense in the book, as I say, because he's actually sitting there watching it. But obviously it intertwines with the topics of, you know, contracting HIV. That goes hand in hand with heroin use a lot of the time, unfortunately. Sick Boy then appears that he is actually genuinely there. And, you know, he's basically there pretending to be a fine, upstanding young man just to rub it in. But brilliantly played by Johnny Lee Miller once again. Back to the hallucinations then, and we see Spud, you know, in chains, looking very sorry for himself on top of the wardrobe, but, you know, swinging his legs so the chain is rattling. It's really well done. Tommy then, like a zombie, kind of crawling along the side of the wall, just adding to Renton's guilt about that whole situation. And then he's finally out of the room. He goes for a HIV test. Bit of a grumpy nurse here, I thought. And she's actually played by the movie's costume designer, Rachel Fleming, who comes back to work. I think she's worked with Danny Boyle on a number of occasions, but certainly comes back for Trainspotting 2. And she had previously worked on Blur and Oasis videos before this. Next, we're into the bingo hall. I love this little scene. You know, he's gradually being allowed back into society, and he's out with his parents here. They're at, I don't know if it's in a pub or an actual bingo club, but Renton actually wins at the bingo. He doesn't even realize it himself. His mother does, but I love the shot where everyone around Ewan McGregor is sped up and he's just there looking so dejected. And you hear the narration, you know, once the pain goes away, that's when the real battle starts. Depression, boredom, you feel so fucking low, you want to fucking top yourself. And again, it's one of the real direct nods to depression in the movie. And, you know, it ties in with the book in that sense. So Renton goes to see Tommy in his flat. You know, we see the outside of the flat is covered in graffiti, informing us that he is definitely, you know, HIV positive. The flat just looks so different to when it was in the movie earlier. Totally bare and just filthy on the inside. The Iggy Pop poster is just barely hanging off the wall. You know, the last time Tommy and Renton were in this room together, Tommy was working out. He looked great. And it was Renton who, you know, was off heroin at the time, but was still looking a bit worse for wear. And, you know, Renton with the kind of obvious question here or an obvious answer, are you getting out much, Tommy? Which it certainly doesn't look like. But Tommy is kind of sarcastic and resentful towards Renton here because he's escaped the HIV virus all this time. Yeah, it's just a tragic scene, and it ends with a really heartbreaking exchange, I think, where, you know, Tommy has asked Renton for money, and as he hands it over, they just have this knowing look between them, little smile from both. But I think on Renton's side, he kind of knows that this is going to be one of, if not the last time that he sees Tommy, and it is the last time. But it was my favourite piece of writing from the novel, and it's just really well captured here in the film. And it ends, you know, with the memorable line, that's actually much earlier in the book relating to a different character. But, you know, no problem, he says as he lends him the money. Easy to say when it's some other poor cunt who's got shite for blood. It's just really effective. But the next chapter, Diane calls to Renton's flat and, you know, after, first of all, checking that he's not on heroin anymore, but happy to smoke some hash with him, which he does. And then we see them on lying on the bed, presumably after having sex, Renton once again lying down. You know, again, I touched on it. Renton is no angel here. He's the adult in the situation. And, you know, I think as a father myself these days, I look at this scene or the scenes with Diane a bit differently. You know, I should pretty much hate him for it, really, but somehow I don't, you know. I don't like it about his character, but this is a flawed human being. He was never portrayed any other way. It's the big escape or temporary escape for him after this. On Diane's suggestion, he moves to London and the music cuts again. It's Ice MC, Think About the Way. He of the memorable line, bum diggy 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 bum diddy bum. And, you know, we get a funny montage here of famous landmarks around London. And obviously some time has passed because Renton is working away. He's an estate agent and he seems to have his shit together somewhat. He's got a decent complexion for one. The work colleague here, I recognize, he's an actor called Eddie Nestor. I recognized him actually from an early 2000s adaptation of The Canterbury Tales done by the BBC, which also starred, incidentally, Johnny Lee Miller. Producer Andrew MacDonald makes a cameo here as well. He's the man in the couple who are being shown around the crappy flat by Renton. I've no idea who the woman is, though. I've checked. I don't know who she is. But once again, Renton is lying on a bed in his new flat and he's reading Diane's letter, which is a funny little read. She's telling him all about Sick Boy's proposal to, you know, obviously become a prostitute for her, standing outside the school gates. We see Spud basically using a curb as a pillow and sending his regards to Renton through Diane. And then she mentions that Francis Begbie has been in the news a lot this week for robbing a jewellery shop. And it's really well done. You know, the doorbell rings and Renton thinks about that, then checks the back of the letter again. And you hear Diane's voice again, Francis Begbie. And he just realises that's who's at the door. You know, oh no. And we actually see Begbie's sovereign ringed hand ringing the doorbell again. And he's come to visit Renton. The music switches then to Mile End by Pulp. And it's just a fucking hilarious scene. Renton once again lying down on his bed and Begbie is standing over him. You know, armed robbery with a fucking replica. How can it be armed robbery with a fucking replica? You know, and solid silver, my arse. It's fucking garbage. And, you know, there's young people investing all their hopes and dreams in this stuff. And he's just on fire here, Robert Carlyle. You know, Begbie completely makes himself at home. He starts throwing fags out into the hall area. And I love the bit where he's just standing there in his kind of white beater, not worn ironically either. You know, white underpants and white socks, shouting after Renton, hey, Rent boy, buy me some fucking cigarettes. And it's just it's a comical foreshadowing of when he says, hey, Rent boy, get me a cigarette in a while. But we see that, you know, Renton's just heading out every day to either to work or just to go shopping for Begbie. And then we see them in bed, once again, Renton lying down. They're sleeping head to toe. You know, Renton's got Begbie's feet in his face. And it's just his worst nightmare. It's just a fantastic scene then where Begbie is watching the racing. And he wants Renton to put a bet on for him, you know, because seeing how he's a fugitive of the law, he can't even walk the fucking streets. So Renton can do it. And the horse he wants is Doncaster, 430, £5 to win, bad boy. And the next bit is just probably my favourite bit involving Robert Carlyle in terms of comic value anyway, where Renton is coming back. He's got shopping and he can just hear Begbie shouting, you know, roars of elation. You know, come on, bad boy. Come on, come on, come on, bad boy. I'm not doing it justice, but I can't shout my house down at the moment. But I just love Renton's reaction here where he just is totally dejected and just turns around, obviously, to go back and collect Begbie's winnings, which he does. And we see them then out celebrating. There's another cut of music. It's Bedrock for What You Dream Of. Quite good, quite a good dance song. And it's quite an important scene, you know, because it's essentially Renton experiencing a rave for the first time, it would appear. And, you know, much like Irvine Welsh himself has spoken about experiencing that in the, you know, kind of the late 80s into the 90s, and having the revelation about writing in the style that he wrote this book in and many others. And there's a great narration here by Renton. Diane was right. The world is changing. Music is changing. Drugs are changing. Even men and women are changing. 1,000 years from now, there'll be no guys and no girls, just wankers. Sounds great to me. It's just a pity nobody's told Begbie. And, you know, we see Begbie laughing like a Bond villain here, which, incidentally, Robert Carlyle would go on to play, of course. But he's on the dance floor with a trans person, which he doesn't know at the time, obviously. And, you know, the trans person is whispering in his ear, obviously enticing him away from the dance floor. And it's like he knew Begbie has this laugh and look on his face, like, well, obviously, this lady wants to go off of me. So he just looks so arrogant. But it's so funny, you see the sign outside the car that they're in, the sign says no ball games. You know, Robert Carlyle said years later that he actually played Begbie as a closeted gay man who has outbursts of violence due to his fear of being outed. And that's certainly exactly what happens here. You know, the trans person is quite lucky that they didn't get murdered in retrospect. But, you know, we see him back at the flat with Renton then, and he's explaining, you know, look, I'm not a fucking bufty, and that's the end of it. He flick, and Renton, you know, retorts then, still making fun of him. You know, let's face it, it could have been beautiful. And then, you know, you just see the turn then in Begbie. And again, just brilliant acting by Robert Carlyle, where he just flicks a switch and flicks at the fag at Renton's face. And, you know, the image of him then holding Renton by the throat and putting the knife to his testicles, that's one of the first stills that I remember seeing of this film in a newspaper before I'd even seen the film, and it always stuck with me. But it's just a great example of how, you know, this character of Begbie can switch from a comic character really to just pure menace. And the doorbell goes again, just to save Renton's balls, essentially. And we see a switch of music, or hear a switch of music again. It's Elastica, 2-1. Another good song. And it's Sick Boy who's come to stay this time. And we see three in a bed. It's amazing that Begbie agreed to that. But the three of them are in the bed again, with Renton kind of sandwiched between these smelly feet. But I love the image of them then, you know, sitting down to eat the fish and chips. And Renton is obviously staring at where his TV would have been before Sick Boy, you know, stole it and sold it. But he got a good price for it. I like as well the way, you know, Renton is sitting there totally dejected again. And Sick Boy takes his fish. You know, are you not eating that? And I love the way, if you notice, you see Begbie looking at this and then looking at his own plate, surveying the situation to decide, well, do I need that fish as well? Obviously not. You know, the TV was fucking rented anyway, by the way. But he asks about his passport then. And then the next quick scene is the point of view from inside a locker at a, you know, a train station or a bus station. And it's Renton locking away his passport for safekeeping, which will come up again. But I like a look that Sick Boy gives Begbie at the fish and chips scene as well, you know, just to say, you know, what's his problem? But he has to get them out of there, and he puts them in the worst place possible, apparently, which is the flat that he has the keys to from his job. And another couple are being shown around, and the two lads jump out of the wardrobe. It's a really funny scene. And I love the freeze frame of just as they're jumping out on this unsuspecting couple, and the sudden stop of the song, the music as well. And it's obviously because we're cutting to another serious scene. It's them going back to Scotland for Tommy's funeral. And we see them at the crematorium. And once again, Stuart McQuarrie, who plays Gav Temperley and the American Tourist, is sitting at the back of the room. Incidentally, Stuart McQuarrie, he was in Ramsay Nesbitt and Taggart. And he was also in 28 Days Later, which was directed by Danny Boyle, brilliant horror film. He was also in an episode of Peep Show, which of course starred David Mitchell, who shares his name with a character from the Trainspotting book. And I most recently saw Stuart McQuarrie in a TV series, a limited series called Dez with David Tennant, which was about the serial killer Dennis Nielsen, who was also mentioned in Trainspotting, the novel. But it is this character of Gav who explains to Renton, you know, what happened to Tommy, how he died. He obviously got a kitten to try and win back Lizzie, and she didn't want it. So the kitten was just hanging around his flat and shitting and pissing everywhere, in Gav's words. And it resulted in toxoplasmosis, which are horrible brain absences. And Tommy ended up having a stroke. and, you know, that was the end for him. And again, a small bit of comic relief in here as, you know, Begbie is sharply looking around at them like a school teacher telling two schoolboys to shut the fuck up at the back of this crematorium. But it cuts then to the pub and everyone is sitting around, including Lizzie and Gail, by the way. But Spud then gives us a rendition of Two Little Boys by Rolf Harris. Probably the less said about that choice of song, the better. But they're back at Swanee's then, the four main characters. And they're toasting Tommy with some cans. They're at Swanee's, by the way, but there's no sign of Swanee. We do actually learn in two deleted scenes, you know, what his fate was. You know, he had his legs amputated. And there is a scene where Renton visits him in hospital. And there's also the scene of him begging on the streets, actually just outside the bus station where the guys end up going. But at his flat or squat, Sick Boy is explaining, you know, the situation to Renton, that he has procured a large amount of heroin from Mikey Forrester and wants to bring it down to London, but they just need some money up front for that. And I just love Renton's line here. You know, we've just come back from Tommy's funeral and you're talking about a skag deal. And then Begbie once again, just brilliant. But Renton as well, you know, Mikey Forrester, Russian sailors, what the fuck are you boys on? It's just a brilliant line. But he does reluctantly agree to it. And, you know, we cut to more change of music here. It's Left Field, a final hit. And, you know, we see Renton is the one who has to test his heroin. I was always a little disappointed that he tested the heroin, but at least he was forced into it, because in the book, he just makes that choice to go back on heroin because he wants to try it because it's so pure. But the funny little scene here where he's trying the heroin and, you know, it's good. It's so fucking good. But you see a thumbs up here from Irvin playing Mikey Forrester to say, you know, I told you this is good shit. But he's still pretty sheepish around Begbie nonetheless. And we cut to the bus ride then down to London, which is a lot longer in the novel, but it's still brilliantly done here. You know, it captures the fact that Begbie's on edge really well. You know, he's supping out of a bottle of Thunderbird straight here. And, you know, his annoyance with Sick Boy is brilliant. You know, did you bring the cards? And the last thing I fucking told you to do was to bring the cards. And I even love Johnny E. Miller here. You know, I've not got them. Why didn't you bring them? And just Begbie losing it then, because I fucking told you to bring them. And Spud waking up from this sudden burst of aggression. But we see Renton emerging from the toilet at the back of the bus after taking, you know, his final hit. Of course, it isn't his final hit because he does have a shot in, I know he's a Terminator 2, Trainspotting 2. But it is quite a short scene. And then we see them in London and just a kind of iconic walk across this street, which looks quite similar to the Beatles and the Abbey Road album, where they're walking into this shitty hotel. And once inside the hotel, we meet Andreas, who, you know, it isn't explained that he's the one who has the relationship with Sick Boy, as it was in the novel. But he is actually played by Kevin Allen, and who was the brother of Keith Allen, who was playing the dealer. The dealer, of course, was named as Pete Gilbert in the novel. He's not named that here. Another brilliant exchange here in the hotel room. You know, we see Ewan Bremner here just pulling off the best looking nervous stance I've ever seen, just beaning against the door, ready to exit at a moment's notice. And I love the way he's wearing these ridiculous sunglasses that he, you know, he takes off momentarily but puts them back on when Keith Allen enters the room again. There's just a hilarious exchange here between Keith Allen and Robert Carlyle, you know. So he's just this posh kind of London drug dealer. And it's like, well, so how much would you like for this? And 20,000 is Begbie's answer. Well, I don't think it's worth more than 15. And then Begbie, you know, well, 19. And then Keith Allen, I'm terribly sorry, I can't go to 19. Well, fucking 16 then. And well, okay, well, fucking 16 it is then, says Keith Allen. And that's the end of the haggling. And, you know, just love the expression on Begbie's face here. He's more than happy with 16 grand, as are the rest of them. And, you know, I love Keith Allen just before he exits here. You know, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'd just like to say it's been a real pleasure haggling with you. And Begbie's retort, you know, fucking brand new, by the way. But we get another change of music then. It's Statuesque by Sleeper. You don't really hear the song too much. It's playing in the background of the pub, Marseille. And it's quite a nice little scene of the four of them just being mates for a couple of minutes. But, you know, as Renton says, it won't last, not like 16 grand. Begbie here looks to be trying to avoid a round, even though he's just come into 4 grand himself. But as he goes to the bar and Sick Boy goes to the toilet, they both joke about what they'd do to Renton if he robbed the money. And this actually seems to put the idea into Renton's head. You know, you see him thinking about it. He's asking Spud what he thinks. Spud is just totally shell-shocked by this. But I love Sick Boy's reaction when he comes back and says, you didn't do a legger then. And Renton, you know, well, we wouldn't run out on a mate. And I love Sick Boy's answer, why not? I know I would. But the scene then becomes obviously quite ugly. And Begbie's obviously never heard the expression, no use crying over a spilt pint, because, you know, he takes exception to this. He does look quite drenched at the front of his suit, in fairness, but probably by his own doing. And you can see Sick Boy and Spud, you know, trying to defuse the situation before it starts. They've seen this all before, as has Renton, but it's no use. You know, this guy says one wrong thing and the music suddenly stops as the glasses fall out of Begbie's hand, all bar one, which he uses to glass this older guy. And it's, you know, it's a horrible scene. He's then putting the boots into him right in the face as he's on the ground. I've been fortunate. I've only witnessed one glassing in my life, and it was just horrible. It was like a gun going off. Totally disgusting. So I have a bit of an idea of what this looks like to see in person. But, you know, he catches Spud with his knife then that he inevitably takes out of his pocket to finish this guy off. And, you know, he's squaring up to everyone then. But he doesn't even have to look around to know that Renton is trying not to get involved. It's almost like he just senses it, that Renton has his back to him as well. It's brilliantly done. And he almost whispers to Renton, you know, hey, Rent boy, you bring me down a fucking smoke. And the camera switches to Renton, you know, who does have his back to him. And you see him looking at the bag again. He's just, his mind is racing at this point. He has to be asked again, but he does bring down a cigarette to Begbie. And I love the way Begbie, you know, just blankly stares at the packet as if to say, you know, you light it as well. And Renton does light it for him, lights it himself and then gives it to him. And then Begbie, you know, blows the smoke in Renton's face. Just one final act of humiliation. And then the music straight away cuts to the brilliant Born Slippy by Underworld. We're into the, you know, a really tense, almost final scene. You know, it's yet another shot of Renton, the last shot of Renton lying down. You know, he's in the bed with Begbie. Everyone else is asleep, or so it seems. He's biting his nails and he's obviously contemplating what to do. And we see him prying the bag from Begbie's sleeping arms, and it's just timed perfectly with the beat of the song as it kicks in. You know, you just expect Begbie's eyes to open up. It's just so tense. And then you see Spud is awake. You know, he's just staring at him and starts shaking his head. He's just afraid to move. And you have to really imagine how afraid Spud must have been at this point, just knowing what was going to happen when Begbie wakes up and he's got to lie there and wait for that then. Possibly expecting a beating himself, but still being a good mate to Renton. Knowing that if he raises the alarm, you know, Renton is fucking dead here. Plus, he's without his share, or so he thinks he is. So to do that, you know, just he'd still rather just lie there and take his chances than be involved in what Renton is doing here. But we do see Renton leaving money in a locker for him later on. But it looks like it's only 2 grand, incidentally. He doesn't give him his full 4 grand share. Renton's walk out of the hotel then and down the street is just so nerve-wracking. You know, the brightness of the day as well just, I think, really adds to the fact that he's finally escaping here to better things. We see Begbie then wrecking the room. Spud and Sick Boy, you know, are outside in the corridor, and as soon as they see the coppers, they're out of there. And you just see one last shot of Begbie pulling the knife out of his pocket, and you just know that, you know, bad things are going to happen in this situation, in this room. Just an iconic shot then of Renton walking over London Bridge, and a slight alteration again of the Choose Life speech, where he's just changing, hoping to change his life for the better. And it just coincides then with the train silhouette title screen once again. And just epic. I love that ending. And we do see Spud finally get his money. And that's the end of the movie. You know, it cuts to stills of the cast then. And the last tune we hear is Closet Romantic by Damon Albarn, his second time appearing on the soundtrack, as it was, of course, for Iggy Pop and Underworld. And the soundtrack just plays such an important role in this movie. It's my favorite soundtrack. It's just fantastic, and it just really adds, you know, to the movie, every song choice, I think. But yeah, I think I'll move on to my next section, which is a new section I'm adding, which I'm calling Connecting Lines. Actually, just mentioned there quickly as well, while I was speaking on bands that, you know, did double duty on the soundtrack, obviously, as well as Underworld, Damon Albarn and Iggy Pop. Sleeper as well had two songs, their version of Blondie's Atomic and their own song Statuesque. And in this section, I just want to quickly mention the connections between this movie and other Irvine Welsh adaptations or novels. So obviously we know that Ewan McGregor, Ewan Bremner, Johnny Lee Miller, Robert Carlyle, Kelly MacDonald, James Cosmo and Irvine Welsh himself return for Trainspotting 2. And Ewan Bremner, Kevin McKidd and Irvine Welsh also appear in the adaptation of The Acid House. And Shirley Henderson, who plays Gail in this movie, is also in the adaptation of Filt. She plays Bunty in that movie. Well, any gripes? Again, they're more just comments, but I'm just wondering, is there any parts of the novel that should have or could have been included? I'm not too sure. Anything, you know, else would have possibly taken away from the main narrative, which was Renton's story. And, you know, just definitely more of the kind of warts and all sections of the novel, which I don't know how they would have come across in this film. You know, sections like him having sex with his dead brother's girlfriend in the toilets at his funeral, or being cruel to animals, you know, assaulting squirrels. I don't think that would have come across too well in Trainspotting the movie. But the only other thing that I'd question or at least discuss is, you know, certain bands who were omitted from the soundtrack. I mean, there's a chapter in the novel entitled There's a Light That Never Goes Out. So maybe a Smith song on the soundtrack, that particular Smith song. Joy Division, I think, as well, would have really fit the feel of the soundtrack. She's Lost Control is mentioned in the novel as well. And just given the amount of, you know, Britpop bands as they're known on the soundtrack, I do think that there was possibly room for an Oasis song on here. But I've heard that Noel Gallagher actually declined for an Oasis song to be included due to the fact that he had no clue what the novel was about. He thought it was actually a movie about fucking Trainspotting. So that was the end of that. And with that, I think I'll move on to the overall thoughts. So this film, as I said at the start, is top three for me. It, you know, it's just perfectly put together voice of a generation, you know, of a certain section of society and of a state of mind. You know, the themes of the book, the hedonism of youth, the amazing times that you can have with friends but still feel trapped and lonely, you know, longing for love and identity, the rebel against your upbringing, both at home and in the community, the longing for escapism, they're all captured here. Some in bigger forms than others, but always in the same nihilistic rock and roll manner that Welsh achieved himself in the book. And all that coupled with fantastic direction by Danny Boyle, whose vision just brings Welsh's words to life in a different but always complimentary way. And, you know, the running sequence, the toilet scene and the overdose scene, they're just the stuff of cinematic legend, as far as I'm concerned, and they're not even my favourite bits. You know, John Hodges' screenplay is just so tight and as good an adaptation of a book that you can get. You know, some sections of the novel were just virtually unfilmable, certainly not for a mainstream movie. But he was able to take the source material and, you know, essentially make the Renton story more romantic and compelling in a way. And, you know, the supporting cast with Robert Carlyle leading the charge just could not have been better. They all knock it out of the park in every scene. Carlyle just has this ability to remain menacing while still being unintentionally funny, you know, with his ridiculous arrogance and mannerisms. Really strong debut by Kelly MacDonald. Just an amazing performance, really. And Peter Mullen is just a brilliant actor. This isn't even his best role and he's still great. Kevin McKidd, the way he goes from being so happy-go-lucky and clean-cut to the tragic figure that Renton goes to visit is just unforgettable work. Johnny Lee Miller's superior and condescending tone of voice for Sick Boy just makes the character, for me, he's just fantastic. And Ewan Bremner just makes Spud so likeable and sympathetic, even though, you know, he's robbing people and accidentally throwing shit all over them at breakfast tables. And Ewan McGregor himself, he's just sublime throughout. You know, it's the role of a lifetime for him. I don't think he's ever surpassed her, and I doubt he ever will. And that's not a slight on his career, but and that's coming as well from a Star Wars and a Shining fan. And, you know, he's had major roles in both of those movie franchises. But for me, much like Richard E. Grant in Whitnail and I, he's just so immense in this, and he gets legendary status for this film alone. He just simply cannot top this performance. You know, he lost 2 stone. He looks amazing in the film. And as I said, his voice for the narration is superb. The way he carries himself, he just has this remarkable mix of quiet confidence and yet vulnerability. But his delivery of some of the lines are just perfect. Like, for example, the "it's shite" being Scottish speech. You know, even just some of his looks that he gives are fantastic. You know, I think there is an opportunity for a more loyal adaptation of the book to be made, but in the form of a longer television series. You know, I think that done right, that could be amazing. And I'd cast the characters more so as they are in the book, you know, less attractive, and including some of their worst characteristics, you know, such as Renton's poor hygiene or Sick Boy's ponytail. But I think as a movie, this could not have been done better. My score for Trainspotting the movie? 5, of course. 5 out of 5. So that's Trainspotting. And I do want to mention quickly, there is a book due for release next year, 2021. That is going to be celebrating the 25th anniversary of this iconic film. It's by J. Glennie and Coattail Publications. And even Irvin Welsh himself has endorsed this book. Now, he said it will be the definitive work on the movie. And it looks to have some really cool, never seen before photos from the movie. And I'm really looking forward to reading that. Look out for that book when it's released in 2021. And yes, on my next episode, I will be covering Irvin Welsh's very first short story collection, which was entitled The Acid House. So another classic book from him, and I'm really looking forward to getting into that. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can catch me again on the next episode. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.